Okay, this thing's going to talk in my closet, at least, but we will start. Thank you for coming out. It's quite a turnout on Friday evening. A lot of people from the community, I can see, and large number of students from my classes, I can see here tonight. My name is Tony Cuniato. I'm going to be introducing Jason Braun in a few minutes. I'm... I'm a professor of psychiatry at the Department of Toronto. I'm also the director of the Buddhism Psychology Mental Health Program that is devoted to studying Buddhism and psychology in the West. I'm also the president of the London College of Buddhist Studies, and they are the ones who are sponsoring this talk tonight. All of you know who this man is, of course. Jason Braun was born in London, England, not that many years ago, from my point of view. He came from a working class background, but won a scholarship, won a scholarship to study theoretical physics at Cambridge University in the late 60s. However, soon after graduating from Cambridge, he traveled to Thailand and became a monk in 1974 at the age of 23. And trained with the venerable Ajahn Chah, who, of course, was instrumental in establishing many Theravada Buddhist teaching locations in the West. For the past about 20 years, 1994, Ajahn Braun has been in charge of the Bodhidharma Monastery in Western Australia, having been invited there years before. Bodhidharma Monastery is the first dedicated Buddhist monastery in the Southern Hemisphere, and today is the largest of the Theravada Buddhist monasteries in Australia. Today he remains the abbot of Bodhidharma Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia, and he's also the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, as well as spiritual advisor to many other Buddhist societies in Australia and throughout Asia. He's also been influential in establishing the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, a monastery specifically for nuns. He has published several books, of which only one is left here that you can purchase, if you wish, after this lecture. And his talks, he's quite prolific in producing talks. They're available for free download off the internet, and if you Google him on YouTube, or search him on YouTube, you'll find hundreds of talks, substantial talks, on every aspect of the Dharma. So you can definitely learn more about after tonight, if you wish. So tonight I'm speaking about a very important subject in a culture, our culture, that tends to be very harsh on itself, as well as sometimes quite narcissistic and doesn't know how to quite attend to itself in a way that's healthy and doesn't descend into egoism or self-inflation. And so I think the topic that you're going to be speaking with tonight, why practice self-compassion, is very, very timely for all of us, as well as for those who may be working through some difficult emotions. So with that, let me introduce to you Ajahn Braun and his talk.
Thank you. Very good. It's a great pleasure to be able to get these teachings of Buddhism, which I learned as a young monk, and actually adapt them to our modern life. And I was telling in the car last night in London, I gave a talk on just the last moment, because I was 3 hours late for the talk because of a traffic jam in London. So the title last night for the talk was Buddhism and Traffic Jams. And that is downloadable now on some website somewhere. And so it's great to be able to take ordinary experiences, situations of our life, and to apply a Buddhist perspective to them. Not just to take away the difficulties and problems of life, but to take it even further and deeper, to make it so that everybody is happy. Is that working? That's even better, yeah. Very good. So this evening's talk is Buddhism without a microphone. But no, let's get to the topic about self-compassion. Now, I'm not sure how many of you read my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, otherwise known as Who Ordered the Truckload of Dung, but there is a very important story in that book on this subject. And when I talk at psychology seminars even corporate seminars, this is one of the stories which I mention because it draws out one of the problems with modern people. So if you've heard this story before, when I ask a question, I want you to be quiet. Don't give the game away. If you haven't heard it before, I want you to think about this and to see what the answer to this riddle really is. So many, many, many centuries ago, there were some monks, seven monks, who were meditating in a cave in the jungle, and they were meditating on compassion. May all beings without exception be happy and well, free from suffering, find respect, be free of sickness and disease, the usual compassion which we all know about. And those seven monks in the cave were the following. There was the head monk. I already mentioned I'm a head monk of many monasteries, but I'm not the spiritual advisor. I'm not the spiritual director. They call me the spiritual dictator. But there was a head monk, and with him was his brother, who also ordained as a monk. And the third monk was his best friend, who also joined. The fourth monk happened to be what you might call his enemy. You know, even people with the best will in the world, sometimes you have personality clashes, you just see things in a different way, you always tend to argue. So the fourth monk, even though he was a good fellow, was the enemy. The fifth monk, he was a very old monk, because sometimes people ordain as a monk in their later years. And this monk was so old, you know, he could die any day. He was at the end of his life, he'd lived many years. The next monk was the sick monk. You know, sometimes even if you meditate, you get ill. I remember once having to go to the doctor, and I was sitting in the doctor's waiting room, and somebody I knew came in, looked at me and said, "I never expected to see you in here." I felt so guilty for being sick. "You're a monk, you meditate, you should be healthy." So even if you eat brown rice, do yoga, meditate every day, you still get sick. So it was a sick monk. And he was so sick, again, they did not know when this monk would die. Even they couldn't really work out who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. Both were at the end of their lifespan. And the last monk, number seven, was what we call the useless monk. Every monastery has one. They cannot chant, they fall asleep when they're meditating, and they can't remember anything about the teachings, the useless monk. But out of compassion, we allow them to come in. So those were the seven monks. And one day, this gang of robbers, they found that cave in the jungle. They realized that this was a wonderful place they could hide from the authorities after stealing, and a great place they could store all the stolen goods, to wait there until the heat died down, and then they could go and sell the goods or go elsewhere. But the problem was the monks were there. So these terrible people, the gang of thieves, they wanted to kill all of those monks. But the head monk was such a good speaker, such a good salesman. If I wasn't a monk, I would be a very good second-hand car salesman. So anyway, so the head monk managed to talk the leader of the robbers into letting all the monks go, except for one. They insisted one monk would have to be killed to show these robbers were serious, and that if any of these monks they let loose told the authorities the location of that cave, they would come for them and they would kill them. Because that's the only way they could keep this location secret. And that was the best the head monk could do. So the head monk came away and looked at the other monks, told them what had happened. But it was the head monk who had to make the decision. Which monk would have to be sacrificed so the rest could go free. Now in a moment I'm going to ask you, if you were that head monk, who would you decide? But before you make that decision, I will repeat the seven monks. There was the head monk himself. There was his brother, who would do anything for his elder brother. The best friend, you know, best friend, they sacrificed themselves for each other. The next monk was his enemy. Life would be so much more peaceful without him. And the next monks, the fifth and sixth monk, were the old monk and the sick monk. They were about to die anyway. It's like, you know, euthanasia. Putting them out of their misery. And of course the last monk was the useless monk, who throughout his whole life had never done anything helpful, useful for anybody. And so the head monk had to make that decision. Now if I'm going to ask you now what that decision was, which one was sacrificed? Don't look at anybody else, make up your own mind. If you know the answer to this story, please shut up. So, any suggestions? Who was sacrificed so the rest could live?
No.
So, if you think that's the right answer, put your hand up. That's the majority of this audience, which is the exact, so the answer I expected, which is why I have to give this talk, that you don't have enough self-compassion. That answer is wrong. Any other suggestions? The sick one? That's really harsh. If you were a doctor and sacrificed the sick, you'd go to jail for that. Any other suggestions? Now that is really hard, isn't it? People, they don't set out to be useless. Some people are born useless. Some people gain uselessness. Some people have uselessness thrust upon them. Yes? Okay, the right answer. You read my book or someone has told you. The answer is that that head monk was unable to make a decision. He could not choose. Why? Because his love, his compassion towards his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his compassion, kindness, love towards his best friend, and even to his enemy, even the old monk and the sick monk, he loved them the same, even the dear old useless monk, he loved. And most importantly, his love for each one of those was no more, no less, than his love towards himself. His love was even. Now when I tell this to audiences who have nothing to do with Buddhism at all, especially Christians, I say, isn't that what your teacher Jesus told you? To love your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't mean to love your neighbor more than yourself, because that's what we do in our Western world. We love ourselves as our neighbor, no more, no less. That's why he was unable to choose. And the reason I tell that story is because all the time most people put their hand up, the first thought is, sacrifice yourself. And there's something very fundamentally wrong with that answer, which shows you haven't learned how to be kind to yourself. And how many of you treat other people so kindly, but you never treat yourself with such kindness? How many of you will forgive other people, but you'll never forgive yourself? How many tell other people, let it go, but you can't let it go yourself? That is a problem. So, the solution. Oh, by the way, before I go on to the solution, people always ask me, but what happened afterwards? And this is based on a sutra. This is in the Theragata Thalaputta, a great monk in the time of the Buddha. It's not quite the same, but it's based on this. But when this monk went to the head monk and said, "Sorry, I cannot choose," and explained, as I have just done, why, that leader of the robbers was so impressed, understanding compassion towards oneself and compassion towards others should be absolutely the same. The head monk and half the other, so the head robber and half the other robbers gave up being thieves and robbers and became monks. And the other half went back to their village and got a proper job. And that's what it said in these scriptures, thousands of years old. And you may laugh, but it's amazing when a person's inspired and they see a deeper meaning of life, then that is more effective to take people out of bad ways of living like thieving and killing and inspire them to another way of life. Not through punishment, not through incarceration, but through inspiration. That actually makes sense to me. But anyway, that's a problem. I mean, what is the solution to this? One of the solutions is because we have been conditioned and brainwashed ever since we were young that we are not good enough. Whatever you do in your life, even as I was saying, I got a scholarship to Cambridge University, but even then, I wasn't good enough. I had to get a first class honours, and that wasn't good enough. You had to get a master's, then you had to get a PhD, then you got to have professorship. Have you got tenure yet? Not good enough. Then you got to get your Nobel Prize. Have you ever noticed in life, no matter what you achieve, it's never good enough? Have ever you noticed that when you have a partner in life, your partner says, "You're not good enough. You're not pretty enough. Not enough sex. Not enough money. Not enough." There's always not enough. We are so critical and fault-finding. And it's also, when we look at ourselves, it is the same. It's not good enough. So how can you be good enough? Even that some people, you're all pretty successful, most of you, but there are some people who will never get to a university. There are some people who probably find it very difficult to get a partner in life. There are some people, we call them damaged goods. People who have been sexually abused. People who have been physically abused in life. People who have gone through hell and are still lingering in there. What about those? I recently gave a talk at a mental health symposium in Australia. These were victims of and sufferers of mental health. And I asked them, said, "Once I finish my talk, I'm going to ask you to go out into a forest or a wood in a park somewhere. And please try and find me a perfect tree. And I'll explain, please find a tree which is vertical, which doesn't lean over, which is not crooked, with all the branches in the right place, with only a smooth bark, not damaged on the surface of the bark. And if you can find me a tree like that, it must be in a government plantation." It's fake. It's controlled. It's not natural. If you go into any forest here in Canada, you'll find all the trees are bent and crooked. They've got scars on the bark. They've got knobs and holes everywhere where they shouldn't be. And that is why they're beautiful. Those are the trees which I like. The crooked ones. The bent ones. The gnarled ones. The ones that are damaged goods. So I tell people, if you are damaged goods, you belong as one of the trees in the beautiful forests of the world. Welcome. Now that is perfection. That is not going in the way of the world where you have to be a supermodel to be attractive as a woman. You know that sometimes I get so popular these days, I have had supermodels on my retreat. When I do have a supermodel books on my retreat, you wouldn't believe the number of guys come on to learn meditation. They never come up with times. But one of my friends, he was on a retreat where the supermodel Kate Moss, she also attended. Now Kate Moss is supposed to be one of the most beautiful women in the world. She's a supermodel for years. And when this friend of mine heard Kate Moss was on a retreat, he wasn't watching his breath. He was watching, which one is it? And interesting thing was, he couldn't find out. He looked at all the women, he could not recognize her. Because Kate Moss is like a blank sheet of paper, which the makeup artists can make into anything they like. And what they make up is what appears on the covers of the glossy magazines. The real Kate Moss, underneath all that airbrushing, is just plain. And so all of you who want to be a supermodel, if you are beautiful already, forget it. It's got to be plain as something which people can control and make up. And how much of what we call success in life, what you're trying to aspire for, what you think you should be, is just made up. It's not real. And when you understand the simile of the tree and the forest, you know, you realize what beauty and perfection truly is. So I say that because in Canada, Australia, many places in our Western world, it's so hard to find a partner and have a good relationship. If you do commit and get married, it's hard to keep together. Marriages are so fraught with difficulties. That's why there are the three rings of marriage. You know the three rings of marriage? Well, the first ring is the engagement ring. Second ring is the wedding ring. And the third ring is the supper ring. And it does. Why are you laughing? Because it's true. It doesn't have to be that way. And in order for it not to be that way, don't try and get a perfect partner. Get a partner. Get a guy who's all bent and crooked. Get a girl who's damaged goods. In other words, appreciate the person for what they are. Change your attitude to what perfection is. And if you change your attitude towards what perfection is, it's amazing that how you can love almost anybody. Have this beautiful relationship where you don't see, you know, the faults as something which detracts from the person. You see the faults which adds to the person. I'm not going to go into my simile of the two bad bricks in the wall in the first book. That's too famous, but it's one of the best similes. I made a wall. First work I did, laying bricks, I made two mistakes. Two bricks were crooked. And I wanted to destroy that wall. I wanted to blow it up, literally. And the reason I wanted to blow it up, because I thought two mistakes spoiled the whole wall. Eventually someone came and said it was a beautiful wall. I thought they were blind. And I said to them, can't you see the two mistakes, the two bad bricks? And they said, I can see the two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 perfect bricks. And it was amazing just how that opened up the psychology of fault finding. You look at your wife, your husband, you may see the faults in him. And if that's all you see, you want to destroy the relationship. However, if you see the 998 beautiful bricks in them, yeah, there's two bad bricks are still there. There's a beautiful wall. And when I told that at a cancer support association talk, a builder came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, even professional bricklayers make mistakes like that. But he said, in the building industry, and I'm sure it's the same here in Toronto, if a builder makes a mistake like that, they call it a feature. And they charge the client an extra couple of $1,000s for it. And what a beautiful ending to that story that is. So the faults make you lovable. Now the idiosyncrasies, like my stupid jokes, they make it interesting and fascinating. They give you character, makes you lovable. And this is one of the reasons why, when we change our idea of perfection, we change our idea of beauty, then we can love ourselves. You don't have to be perfect to love yourself. You are damaged goods, you've got broken branches, you've got gnarled barks. You're beautiful. When you look at it that way, then you can love yourself and accept yourself and embrace yourself as you are. Just beforehand, there was an interview for this TV. They're going to hear a couple of these stories again because they should be shared with everybody. The person who taught me love was not the Buddha, was not Ajahn Chah, was my own father. One of the key stories, and you may have heard this before, but I always use this and I embellish it, I expand on it, was when as a 13-year-old young boy took me aside in his old car. He was a poor man. I know everyone sometimes that they say they are poor because it gives them cred, but I really was poor. And my father, in a beat up second hand old car, he turned around to me after picking me up from school and said, "Son, there's something important I want you to remember. Wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, however you turn out, please remember the door of my house will always be open to you." And that's how he said it. And look, there's some experiences you have in life you will never ever forget. And I know the place, I know the details, it's stuck in my mind forever. But I never understood it. I was only 13, a boy. And only when I became a monk, when you have the time to contemplate and to really investigate, did I understand what he truly meant. It wasn't his house that he meant, it was his heart. He was saying to me, "Son, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, however you turn out, if I'm proud of you or embarrassed about you, I don't care. You're my son. The door of my heart will always, forever be open to you." It was my first experience of unconditional love. And of course I tried to practice that on many other people, as a monk especially. Doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter what you say, doesn't matter where you go. No, Piyala, I go and stay with her every time I come into Toronto. "Piyala, if you become a Christian, the door of my heart will still be open to you." Of course, who cares? But the most important thing was, eventually I had to turn that on myself. To say to myself, "Ajahn Brahm, now I haven't always been done good things. Sometimes you make mistakes. I've got my stupid things which I do from time to time. I mean, I do sort of tell the same old joke again and again and again. And the reason is because I know you've heard it many times again, but I enjoy saying it." "I'll tell you my latest joke. It's nothing to do with the talk. I'm just doing this because I love myself and I love telling it." There's two very elderly men. Now, maybe in their 80s. And because they weren't working, you know, every day they go and meet in the park somewhere in Toronto, you know, and swap stories, you know, tell a few lies and jokes. They just enjoyed each other's company. And one day, one of those men never turned up. And his friend thought, well, he's in his 80s, maybe 86, maybe he's got sick. So he spent the day by himself, the next day by himself, the next day by himself. After a week, he thought, "My friend must have died." 86, that happens. So he's a bit lonely, but after 1 month his friend came back. And he said, I'm so glad to meet you again. I thought you were dead. What happened to you? You've been away for over a month. And his friend said, I've been in prison. So been in prison at 86. What happened? Well, said the 86-year-old, you know that coffee shop we go to every now and again? Now, the young lady who was serving the coffee, she accused me of rape. And I had to go to court. And when the charges were read and I was asked, how do I plead? I was so flattered, I pleaded guilty. And the judge gave me 30 days for lying in court. So even though that's got nothing to do with the talk, out of compassion to myself, I said it. So now I've got my idiosyncrasies, and of course that makes you lovable. So all the idiosyncrasies, the so-called faults you think you have, love them. And even some of the terrible, painful experiences you've had in life, love them too. I've done a lot of work with survivors of trauma and torture. You know, Canada's a really compassionate nation. You know, you allow people to come into this country who've been through disgusting stuff. You know, in torture chambers, multiple rapes, victims of some of the terrible conflicts and oppressive regimes in our world. You can give them a home. You can give them a house and food. But we need to give them much more than that. We need to give them some sort of healing. Because they're carrying with them, you know, the screams of those tortures. They echo in their hearts. You know how you fix that? I tell them. And it's powerful. Incredibly powerful. It brings me emotional goosebumps when I say this and how well it works. I ask them to imagine a little heart. And I was saying earlier, I did some biology, but I'm not quite sure what a heart looks like, so I used one of the hearts on a Valentine's Day card. And I imagine that just, you know, in my chest area. And I imagine this little heart with a door, usually a double door. And I imagine flinging that double door open, opening the door of my heart. And I imagine this little staircase coming out, just like in the old aircraft, going down to the ground. And I notice at the bottom of that staircase, outside of my heart, is all those experiences which really hurt. All the stuff I have done, which I'm ashamed of. All the parts of me which I've been trying to keep out, trying to deny, even trying to fix and change. And I imagine all those little people, which were me in the past, down the bottom of the stairs, alone, afraid, and I invite them in. Come up. All those parts of me, the rape, the beatings, the cheating, the disappointment, the pain, come up. The door of my heart is open to you as well. I imagine the other part of me, the one I'm proud of, the happy part, the good memories, standing at the top of the stairs, and welcome each and every one of us, give this huge hug, come in, we're now together. You are who I am, the happy part, the painful part, that's all me. Come in. We have this beautiful reunion, and I don't need anyone at the bottom of the stairs. Not even things I would wish that I'd never ever done, which never happened to me. I wish that would never happen. They come in as well. And the result of that is this beautiful catharsis. Because the problem is, when any bad thing has happened to you, you have self-loathing. Lack of self-esteem. You don't like yourself because you're not united with yourself. You're outside. Half is outside, half is in. When you bring it in, an incredible sense of peace. And recently there was one lady who was counseled like that. She'd been very brutally raped. And when she mentioned that to one of her friends in my temple in Perth, one of my friends said, "Oh, that's a terrible thing which happened to you." And she scolded that young man and said, "What do you mean, a terrible thing which happened to me? That's who I am. That's me. That's made me what I am. I'm not going to be afraid of that anymore. I've embraced it. I'm at peace with it. I've grown with it." And that incredible transformation happens. And that really, really brings tears to my eyes when you see that. That's how compassion to oneself works. Not just compassion to the nice part, the pleasant part, but all of you. You're at peace with yourself now. And all of those terrible things which happened to you, the scars, the crooked, the bent stuff in you, that makes you beautiful. That makes you lovable. That makes you not a tree planted by the Canadian government, but real, natural. We are all damaged goods. That's why we can love ourselves, be compassionate to ourselves, accept ourselves. And it also means, this is weird, but what you're afraid of usually happens to you. What you don't want to happen usually occurs. So if you are at peace with those things, they never happen again. If you forgive your mistakes and the mistakes of others, they don't reoccur. It's a natural law. If you're afraid of them, keep them out. Fearful of them, embarrassed with them, ashamed of them, they reoccur. So this is a beautiful way. It's not just easing the past problems. It's making sure these problems never happen again. How can you do that? Sometimes another story which comes up every time I went to prison, not because I did something wrong, because I was in there counseling, helping other people. But if any of you are prison visitors, you know, go there to sort of help out, to teach, to whatever you do as counselors or therapists or whatever, please, you must always do what I do. Keep a record of the number of hours you spend in jail counseling, helping people, to be used as credit in case you ever do something wrong and get sentenced. I've got lots of credits. If I do something wrong, get sentenced, I can say, "Look, I've already spent, you know, something." But sometimes people say, "What's it like going into prison with all these murderers and thieves and rapists and paedophiles?" And I said, "I've never seen a murderer. I've never seen a rapist. I've never seen a paedophile. All I've ever seen is a person who's killed. I've seen a person who was raped. I've seen a person who has abused children." I'm going into sensitive stuff, because we should never avoid the sensitive stuff to make this talk real. I've seen people who are called paedophiles, who have abused kids. But they're not paedophiles. They're people who've done bad things. But that does not make them a bad person. This amazing thing happens. That if you have done bad things, it doesn't make you a bad person. Because when you see the other part of you, the other bricks in the wall, then what happens, you realize that this isn't who you are. You're not a bad wall with bad bricks everywhere. You have made mistakes. Which means when you look at the other parts of the brick wall, it means that you realize you are not a bad person. Which means you do have your self-esteem, your compassion towards yourself. And that's what I have to do when I visit prisons, to teach paedophiles how to have compassion towards themselves, so that when they get released from jail, they never ever do such a thing again. it works. And one of the reasons why it works, these days I do get a lot of praise. Any blame, especially any blame for this talk, you know, if something goes wrong, please don't blame me. Please blame the organisers. But any praise for this talk, here please. But we have bad things, we have good things in our life. But the whole point of this is to try and make sure we learn from the mistakes and we never do them again. So compassion towards yourself means you accept who you are, what you've done. You never focus on that as everything and all of you. You realise there's another part of you which is also really important. And because of that you learn. If you have no self-esteem, you just give up. I'm a paedophile, I'm a thief, I'm a murderer, that's who I am. You keep repeating that. And again, the praise I got was from a prison officer who called me, another thing I will never forget, he called me at my monastery and he said, can you please, please, please come back to our prison to teach? And I said, I can't. I have to go to Toronto, to London, to all these other places. I said, I'm too busy these days. I'll send another monk. And he said, no, I want you. Why me? And he said that he'd been in the prison service his whole career, in many, many different prisons. And he said, I've noticed something very unique. All of the people you have taught never ever come back into jail. We want you back. And that was a praise which I cherish. Why was that? Because, as one prisoner kept saying, he was a murderer, or rather a person who'd murdered. It's only two bricks in the wall. It's only two bricks in the wall. I'm not a bad person. And because he realized he was not a bad person, he could have compassion towards himself. Because he had compassion towards himself, he never ever did those terrible things to anybody ever again. That's how self-compassion works. It's powerful. And it solves the problems of our world. Now that's talking about murderers, paedophiles, people who do indescribable things. People who have had indescribable things done to them. If they can forgive, have compassion, and allow all those terrible things to come into their heart, and embrace everything, can't we? So, now you know why you should do it, how you should do it is the next. And there are simple exercises which we do. One exercise which I do, which I haven't said on the camera before, was every morning, I got into this habit when I was a very young monk, every morning when I wake up, I say, good morning me, have a great day me, because even if you're married, the first person you notice when you wake up is yourself. Your partner may be next to you, but you notice yourself first of all. So how about saying to yourself, good morning me, have a nice day. If you had someone you loved very much, maybe a child, say good morning darling. If you have compassion towards yourself, you react the same way, good morning me. And when I go to bed at night, before I fall asleep, good night me, have a great day. Or have a great sleep, sorry. I actually wish myself good night. I'm a monk, I don't have a partner. No one sleeps next to me, not even a teddy bear. But I always say good night to me. Have a great night. I'm expressing compassion towards myself. And the other thing which I said in the just beforehand, a little interview, sometimes people just need something more physical rather than just, you know, ideas and talks. So there's two things which I'm going to ask you to do. The first is the 20 push-ups. Exercise is really important. You all exercise in the morning? No. All you do exercise is you lift up the cup of coffee. But real exercise in the morning. 20 push-ups every morning. Now don't worry if you've got a bad back or if you're very old or a bad heart or whatever it is. You can still do Ajahn Brahm's 20 push-ups. I will now describe them, but I want you to also follow my instructions.
get your two fingers, side of the mouth, push up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 20 times every morning in front of the mirror. Give yourself some compassion. Don't you notice how people in the West don't know how to smile? Because they don't practice. You've got to exercise these muscles, get them going. Those of you who saw me do my photo session beforehand, you know, when people were asking me to sign the books and photo. No joking, there's a few people from Indonesia here. When I go to Indonesia, sometimes those photo sessions last 2 hours. And I've got a smile for 2 hours. That takes practice and training. That's right, 1, 2, 3, 4, every morning, and you can smile like a monk. That's the first exercise. If that doesn't work, and you're really feeling down, now you're literally sacked from work, you lost your job, now your wife has just said, I'm going to marry your best friend. You've just been told you've got cancer and it is incurable. All these terrible things. So the next exercise, I have got to put this one down to be able to do this one, so I'm going to raise my voice. Put out your hands, please, like me. Follow me. Bring them in. In. Those of you who resisted doing that have got a problem with self-compassion. What's wrong with doing that? Doesn't it feel good? It releases all those endorphins into the bloodstream. That's what happens. So that self-compassion and kindness really work. And also for your health. I've been telling people a funny story. It's compassion is good for your health. So much so, there was a friend of mine, disciple, end of his life, he was in his late 70s, early 80s, got cancer, treated by this, treated by that, had many diseases, prostate, diabetes, well, you name it, he had it. That's what happens to you when you get old. And eventually they sent him to the hospice. You have hospices in Canada? So they sent him to the hospice to die. So a very beautiful hospice. And when he arrived in hospice, he told me, you know, that they gave him the menu for lunch and dinner and breakfast and stuff. And he said, oh, I can't have this. I've got diabetes. I can't have this because my cholesterol. I can't have this. And the nurse says, what do you mean? You're dying. You can have whatever you want. Well, diabetes is not going to kill you. You're not going to die of a heart attack. You know, you've got cancer, that's going to kill you. So I said, really? I can have whatever I want, any food, as much sugar, syrup I want? Yeah. Double ice cream, double chop with oil on the top if you want. And so he told me this was great being in hospice. For years, his wife told him, you can't eat this, you can't eat that. And now he could eat whatever he wanted. 1 week later, he'd improved so much, they sent him home. True story. 3 months or 4 months later, the cancer came back and he went there and died. But why was it that when he had joy and happiness, compassion to himself, his health improved dramatically? Compassion and kindness is an important part of your health. So little push-ups is not fun. This is actually good for your health and longevity. It should be subsidized, you know, by the Canadian Health Service. Saves the government money. That's what self-compassion is all about. Now, the last little question, which before I open up for Q&A, is, yeah, if you're compassionate towards yourself, does that make you egotistical? And the point is, it does not make you egotistical at all. That is a myth. I was told, don't praise yourself, you just get big-headed. Don't be kind to yourself, because you should be kind to others first of all. And the point is, if you are kind to yourself, if you recognize your good qualities, if you love yourself, you don't get big-headed. You get big-hearted. You get compassion. The more compassion you give to yourself, the more compassion you grow for others. One of the reasons people are mean to one another is because they're mean to themselves. I think it was actually His Holiness the Dalai Lama said this. If the boss at work or someone you know really gives you a hard time, they're very angry and mean to you, please have compassion towards them. You only have to put up with them for so many hours, 5 days a week. They have to live with themselves 7 days a week for the rest of their life. And that's profound, because the way you look at others is the way you look at yourself. So be kind to yourself, be compassionate towards yourself. You won't be such a pain in the ass to other people. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Okay, you may all be seated. Thank you so much. Okay, questions? Any questions will be entertained. Yeah? Can I elaborate on narcissistic? Okay. I think what you really mean with narcissism, just thinking of oneself, I'm going to answer that question with a little simile of what I explain to people the time when I do marriage celebrations. Have two people come together in marriage, and I do the blessing for them, and I have to give them good advice. Because if they have any problems, they will come and bother me later. So the advice I give them, I first of all look at the bride. Look her straight in the eye and say, from this moment on, you're a married woman. You must never think of yourself. She nods, sweetly in agreement, straight away. Then I look at the guy and say the same thing to him. From this day on, you must never think of yourself. And I've done this in many different countries. I don't know why it is, but the guy always pauses, first of all. You girls, you know that. And he eventually says, okay. But then I look at him and say, from this day on, you must never think of your wife. And I look at her and say, from this moment on, you must never think of him, your husband. This is teaching through the method of confusion, because people are always opening their minds, trying to figure out what this means. And the answer is, I tell them, from this day on, you must never think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. From this moment on, you must only think of us. Us. You're married, you're in it together. If you think of yourself, that's what you mean by narcissistic selfishness. If you think of the other, you think that's compassion. That is not compassion. That is burning yourself up, sacrificing yourself. That is like the people who said, oh, that monk, he sacrificed himself so the others can actually live. That is a usual Western attitude which is dysfunctional. But instead the parents think it's about us. So the married couple think it's about us. We're in it together. Those 7 months, we're in it together. It's about us. I can't distinguish one from the other. So in a marriage, if there's any problem, whose problem is it? Our problem, yeah. If there's a problem with the Muslim community in Canada, whose problem is it? Our problem! Don't think it's those bloody Muslims. It's our problem. Once you change the attitude like that, it's amazing how many different solutions, which you never thought of before, can come up. If it's somebody else's problem, it never gets fixed. If it's my problem, it never gets fixed. It's our problem. And that answers a question about narcissism. Compassion to me, to you, we're in this hall together. That's why it's always our problem. Okay? Very good. Yes. Very good.
And how does self-compassion relate to this?
Okay. Well, I realized that I was in a bit of a problem. I never chose a title. If I chose a title, it would be No Self Compassion. Compassion to your no self and to my no self. And to all no selves. May all no selves be happy and well. Just like you're kind to planet Earth. Okay, it's hard to say that planet Earth has got a consciousness. It hasn't got sort of a brain, a neural framework which we can really discern. We still have to be kind towards it. Why? Because we're in this together. We're kind to even mobile phones and tablets. Don't be embarrassed about that, because it's just like, you know, the mistakes on a tree. They're crooked, you're crooked too. So we open the door of your heart to all people who use their mobile phones during the lecture. Although I must say that sometimes before lectures in my Buddhist temple, I always say, please turn off your mobile phones and your tablets, because especially during meditation, if a phone goes off, the phone makes bad karma. And in its next life, it gets reborn as a parking meter, which is the lowest form of life for technology. So what we're doing is, compassion is selfless. There's no self there at all. And this is actually what happens when you don't make a distinction between myself and my partner in life. You don't make a distinction between yourself and the person sitting next to you, behind you, in front of you. And you find that goes further towards the Buddhist idea of no self. No me. Me is you. You is me. You make me. I change you. We change each other. Come back. You've got another thought going on in your head. We're saying good morning to this person, or this being, this process, which you live with. So, call it a process. If you're fully enlightened, there's no self there at all, full arahat, a Buddha, then of course you don't need to say anything. But because you're not, you better start saying it quick. Okay, another question. Okay, yes, thank you.
We should try to refrain from fault finding. But, okay, we can stop fault finding in a person, but what about bad ideas? That Sam Harris said recently, certain ideology in the world is like a mother lode of bad ideas. So certainly discernment of what is right view or wrong view is okay?
Yeah, it's sometimes right view and wrong view, it depends for what purpose. I know that I read many, many years ago the old philosophical conundrum, is the glass half empty or half full? And the answer was, it depends whether you're drinking or pouring. So a lot of times, good idea or bad idea is actually contingent, you know, on what the purpose is, what the goal is. So a lot of times some of these theories which come up, called religion, that sometimes, that what are they trying to serve? What's their purpose? But the problem with ideologies, it's not actually the thoughts or the religion, it's how they're used for political purposes, for the purposes of self-aggrandizement making yourself big, aggrandizement or something. Or the purpose of making power, the purpose of making money. So some of these are beautiful teachings, but it's how they're used is the problem. So it's not just good ideas or bad ideas. It's how they're employed, how they're used. That is more the problem. For example, in Cambridge University, there is to this day the Flat Earth Society. And you think, in a great university like Cambridge, the Flat Earth Society. And to be able to become a member of that, you have to present a paper proving the Earth is flat. They say that's a stupid idea, but how it's used is to notice that a fine intellect can prove anything. And you manage to concoct an argument, you know, which can convince other people that it may be right, even though you know it's wrong. So, you know, from the Flat Earth Society, we have spawned many politicians. From that, of marketing gurus, from that sort of premise, you know, it's how it's used can be actually quite useful as an intellectual exercise, sometimes just for good fun. So it's how it's used. The idea doesn't live by itself, out of context. So Sam Harris doesn't quite get it. What do you think?
Well, there are certain ideas that can lead to violence and killing innocent people, so certainly those are bad ideas, right?
Yeah, but it's the way they're used. Or is it inherently bad? Sometimes today's good idea is seen in the perspective of the future, turned out to be a bad idea. Sometimes bad ideas later on turn out to be good ones.
But if the idea kind of prolonged or prolonged,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, prolonged spider, delusional fighter.
Isn't it the bad idea?
Because it promotes it. Again, it's the use of it. Because sometimes ideas in a university are just ideas. And sometimes it's great to put in controversial ideas. You know, silly ideas. I think what was that, one of those philosophers in England, and he always had to get creativity, you just put out something totally impossible, something totally stupid. And from that, it just changes the way the mental processes work. And from that you get new innovative ideas. You know, it's just a way of saying some stupid idea, and then from that you can actually build up some really interesting ideas. Who knows? But anyway, I'm not going to buy into that one, because certainly compassion is a good idea. Yes, go on. Okay, this is Buddhism. Mindfulness and vipassana meditation. Number one, there is no such thing as vipassana meditation in the teachings of the Buddha. It came afterwards. Vipassana and samatha are a pair. Samatha is not concentration. It means stillness. Stillness and insight always go together. My master, he would put up his hand and say, "You see the front of my hand, but the back is right behind it. Now you see the back of my hand, you can't see the front. But the front hasn't disappeared, it's just right behind." So that's samatha, that's vipassana, that's stillness, that's insight. You cannot separate them. And in fact, when it comes to mindfulness, being able to see things clearly, it gives rise to insight. You have to be still, first of all. If you go to a lake in the mountains and there's a ripple on the surface or waves on the surface of that lake, you can never see a clear reflection of the moon and stars above. But if that lake is perfectly still, without a ripple, without any movement, then the image of the moon and stars is perfect, it's not distorted. That's a simile. It's only through such stillness that you get insight, you see things as they truly are. Otherwise, you distort reality. It's not real insight. Stillness comes first. And how do you become still? Bottle of water. Those at the front, I'm now going to hold this perfectly still. Has it stopped moving yet? It's actually, it's still moving. Oh, concentrate. I'm not sure if you can see, but quite honestly, when I concentrate, it moves more. And many people, when you meditate, it gets so frustrating. You can never get still, you can never get inside. It sounds so easy, but you just can't do it. You try. You've got the wrong instructions. There's a very easy way to get this bottle of water perfectly still. Put the damn thing down. Let it go. Stop trying. That's the hardest thing for modern human beings to do. Instead, open the door of your heart to the bottle of water, no matter what it does. It's not just mindfulness, but compassion is important for success in meditation. And by compassion, it's accepting your crooked mind with all the scars, all the damage, sloth and torpor, restlessness, accepting that as a beautiful mind which does not need to be changed. Some people meditate in the same way that someone goes into the forest and tries to straighten up all the trees, tries to sand down all the knobs, fill up all the holes in the bark. You try and make the mind straight and perfect. That's why you get frustrated. But when you love the mind for what it is, when you are open the door of your heart to the mind, then there's no business, nothing to do anymore. It's perfect enough. You can enjoy the forest without trying to change it. Because there's no business, you find peace. How many of you find peace in the forest? Or peace by the oceans? Because you can't change those. So when you stop trying to change your mind, you find peace. Through peace, you find joy in stillness. And through stillness, you get great insights. Our trouble is, we hate our minds. We're trying to change them. We're trying to make them perfect. Instead of changing our attitude. And being compassionate to ourselves, to our mind, to our no-self, whatever you want to call it. Then, that's how you meditate. And because compassion has to be included with mindfulness, that's why, 2 years ago I think, I coined a new word, kindfulness. Not mindfulness, kindfulness. Just changing one letter changes the whole ball game. And you heard it here first. Toronto University, the fount of all modern ideas. There's one question here, yeah?
You mentioned that you practice Theravada Buddhism, but what's the difference between Theravada and Mahayana?
Absolutely none. I do not practice Theravada Buddhism. I practice Buddhism. Because, look, there is no difference. All these sects, I'm a celibate, I don't have sex. Sorry, that's terrible. I apologize for that. But all these yanas, no, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, this is, why do we keep separating everything? So I started off with that, but realized there's no difference between Mahayana monks, Theravada monks, Vajrayana monks. There's no difference between men and women. So blacks, whites, yellows, greys, whatever, pinks. I'm a pig, I'm not a white. What difference is there? I can't see it. So anyway, what type of Buddhism do I practice? You try and bring everything together, okay? So try to bring everything together. What should you call it? So the three major traditions of Buddhism, Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. I took the H from Hinayana, the AHA from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. And what does that spell? Hahayana. That is the type of Buddhism I practice. Hahayana. Why not? Any other questions? How's the time going?
It's 10 after 8.
Okay.
We'll stop.
Yes.
After the first question, if you've never really met Jesus before, what's the best way to start?
Is number one now. This is going to be a long answer to a quick question, because another really great story in my first book came from Leo Tolstoy. I read this as a student when I was at Cambridge, and it just, I couldn't think straight for days. It really turned me over, because it was changing my way of looking at life. And I should have mentioned this before, about answering the question about, you know, self-centeredness, narcissistic, whatever, jet lag, okay? Because The Emperor's Three Questions was a story written by Leo Tolstoy to raise funds for the Jewish community who were oppressed in Russia at the time. And that story, which I read, was incredible. He envisaged an emperor who had it up to here with organized religion, always arguing with each other, fighting with each other. And for goodness sake, they're supposed to be religions of love, and you just kill other people for, you know, who loves the most? Who loves the most perfect? And we go and fight with each other, argue with each other. There's something fundamentally wrong there. So he had it up to here with organized religion, like many modern people today. Let's get our own religion. And so what many people do in the West, take a bit of this, a bit of that. You know, it's a supermarket. You know, you don't just take one product, you take a bit of each and, you know, cook your own. So it's called fusion. So he decided to try and make his own religion, but he wanted to have something practical, which would make his work as an emperor easier. So he realized there was only three big questions he needed to find the answer to. And the first question, when is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What is the most important thing to do? The who, when, and what. When is the most important time? Now is where your future is being made. Right now. And now is also where your past is being made. Tomorrow you'll remember this evening. It'll be your past. So if you make this evening a beautiful, happy, wonderful time, then your past will be beautiful and wonderful, because you're making your past now. You're also creating your future right now. It's incredibly important to be here much more often. In fact, I often say, when I go travelling, even to Toronto, it's very rare. In this big city of how many million people? How many? I don't know, a lot anyway. It's very rare to come across a human being in Toronto. Very rare to come across a human being. You come across many human going, many human doing, but how many human beings are there here? If you come into the present moment, welcome, you're a human being again. You're being here. Now is the most important time. Who is the most important person?
Me.
Oh, come on, I just taught you about compassion and it's got to go everywhere. I don't know how many people are so self-centered. That is narcissism. The answer, which really shook me up, the one in front of you, is the most important person in the world. So when you go home and your kid comes up to you, welcome home, mummy. They're important. Don't say, I'm busy, I've got to go and do something, check my emails. No, they are the most important person. And you're meditating. The slop and torpor, the restlessness, whatever else you're experiencing right now, that is the most important meditation object in the world for you. Don't try and get rid of this to get something else. That's not meditation. Don't try and attain something. I want to get enlightened. If you try for enlightenment, you'll never reach it. This moment contains the seed of enlightenment. It's important, no matter what it is. What's the most important thing to do? Is to care. Whatever you're doing right now, care for it. And that Emperor's Three Questions, the one in front of you is the most important person in the world. When you look in the mirror and doing your 20 push-ups, when you say, good morning, you're with you. And most of the time you spend alone in life. And that's why most of the time in life you are the most important person in the world. There's no one else there. The most important thing to do, very simple, care for yourself. You're with someone else, care for them. You know, you're with the essay you have to write to get, you know, your credit for this course. That essay is the most important thing in the world. Care for it. Then you'll be incredibly successful in life. You know the secret of meditation. It's not trying to get somewhere, not trying to get rid of things. It's like this moment is the only one you have. Whatever you're experiencing right now is most important. That's mindfulness. Giving this moment real importance and caring for it, which is kindfulness. Simple but incredibly potent. Okay, one last question.
One more question. Good
one. Yeah, at the back. So you've got a hand up in the back. Absolutely, convert them. I like converting people. People say, Buddhist, you shouldn't go around converting people. No, it's okay to convert them to kindness. Don't convert them to being Buddhist or to being sort of whatever. But if you give compassion towards other people, they're not giving it back to you. You are changing them. You are actually giving them another opportunity. Because a lot of time, if people are unkind to you, they expect unkindness back. And it's just the unkindness, the hate, the wars, the violence, the lack of respect goes on and on and on. To break that cycle, be kind to them. It's irresistible compassion. It wears people down. So there's a story in the book about this. I taught this in a prison. The power of compassion. And one of the prisoners said, look, it's all right for you to speak. In a monastery, compassion will work. Maybe out there in the world, maybe, maybe not. But in the prison, no way. If you're compassionate to somebody, if you smile at them, they will punch you. And I said, yeah. He said, yeah. I said, no way. He said, no way. I said, okay, competition. Said, who is the person in this prison you hate the most? So one of the prison officers. Great, that's it. Now I want you to be kind to the officer. He's a bastard. Doesn't matter. Be kind. And it was actually this prisoner's job to serve him tea and coffee every day. That was his job. And so I asked him, see what works. Don't just make a cup of tea or coffee for him. Get the best coffee you can find in the prison. Use your resources. Find out what he likes. How many spoons of sugar or honey, and he likes it hot or not so hot. Likes biscuits or sandwiches, whatever. Really, you know, pamper him. And see what he does. And after a week I came back again and said, total waste of time. He doesn't even admit I exist. I'm making him a cup of coffee. Good morning, sir. I hope you enjoy your coffee. Is this what you like? He doesn't respond at all. He doesn't even move. So carry on. It took 3 months of this And then one day he gave this prison officer a cup of tea, you know, with cream or something, and special biscuits which he found out he liked. He said, "Hope you enjoy your tea and biscuits, sir." And this prison officer said, And that was so exciting. And I knew there was only, as a crack, the war would come down pretty quickly. Another month, he gave him a cup of coffee, which he liked. He said, "Hope you enjoy your coffee." And this prison officer turned around and said, "Thank you." And that went around. I was told, there's always a grapevine in the prisons in Australia, like in here in Canada. That went around the grapevine, and no one could believe that that prison officer could say thank you to a prisoner. I won, or rather compassion won. It took a long time, but it always wins. Try it. It will win. And what do you want to be? Do you want to have that person always in their pain forever? It doesn't really matter. If you give them anger back, compassion back, it's up to you. If you give them compassion back, it changes them. But you know, if they really are sort of violent, there's another saying I always remember, and I will say to you, it's good to give compassion, but remember, always love the tiger at a distance. Don't get too close. Much better than watching the TV.
Thank you very much for your sharing your wisdom on this topic and many other ones. Amazing section to listen to. If you want to buy the remaining book, please come now and do that. As well as the students who are here for my classes, I'll have a sign-up sheet over there. And I'll have a pamphlet for the book program over here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. See you.